Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mat-Su Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. You can hear all of our download podcasts on mushingradio.com. Make sure you follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Mushing Radio. We look forward to your comments, questions, and concerns. We are continuing our Iditarod Musher series tonight. We're talking to Charlie Bania. Charlie, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Robert?
Pretty good. Did I butcher your last name? I know I just found out how to say it here a second ago.
A little bit. It's pronounced Bania.
Bania. Charlie Bania is on Mushing Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I understand you're calling us from Illinois. Is that correct?
Correct. I'm calling from Edison, Illinois.
So that is where you grew up, how you kind of got started in the sport. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're all about, Charlie.
All right. I pretty much grew up in Edison my whole life. I'm currently 40 years old right now, and I started following Iditarod when I was, I'd say, probably in my early teens. Pretty much watched a little bit of it on TV when they had some short clips on it, and then followed it in the newspaper. And the first time I went to Alaska was in 1991 with my father, and we drove up from Illinois. And we visited a couple kennels, and I pretty much fell in love with the sport. And then came back to Alaska a couple years after that, and then I attended my first Iditarod in 2006. I came up for that winter, watched it, and then I met G.P. Jones and went out to his kennel and toured it, and he gave me the opportunity to get on the runners and go about a quarter-mile loop that he has around his kennel, and then that kind of got hooked from there, and here I am.
It is very quick to get hooked on the mushing sickness, is it not?
Absolutely. It very much so is.
So when people are listening to our show, I'm sure they're thinking, Illinois, Iditarod, doesn't quite think of being a mushing capital. I know Hugh Neff is from Evanston, Illinois, but not a whole lot of mushing going on in Illinois, is there?
No, not at all. I know they have some rescue shelters out here with Huskies, and they have a couple of different like winter events they have here and there, but really not that much at all in Illinois. I know Wisconsin, as you get up there, and Minnesota and Michigan, they're more involved in mushing.
So you said that you worked with, or you met up with G.B. Jones in 2006. Is that correct?
Correct.
So I am sure that once you kind of caught on to the mushing bug at that point, you had to figure out how you were going to get dogs and, you know, work your way up to Alaska, you know, get 100% involved. What have you done in the last 6 or 7 years to lead up to this point now? What type of races have you ran? You know, where are you at in your mushing career as we see it right now?
I ran the Kinnick 200, and that was my for one of my qualifiers. And then I had done the Northern Lights 300 two times, and those three races qualified me to run Iditarod. This last season, I wanted to run a lot more races, but with the weather conditions, with it being very warm, I know kind of rainy on, I think it was Christmas or New Year's. You know, Kinnick 200 was canceled this last year. And there were some other ones like Don Bowers and some other shorter ones. But I was able to compete in this year's Iditarod. Unfortunately, I had a scratch in between Uniclete and Chetulik, just on the well-being of my dogs. They were getting, I was only down to 7 dogs, and they were getting really tired, and I didn't want to push them any further because I knew I couldn't make it that far anyway. But as far as dogs, pretty much started my own litters. Some from G.B. Jones. I bought a couple dogs from Streeper, and pretty much bred our own the last several years, and now we have a total of 36, I believe. And we're going to see which out of those 36
So tell folks that may not be 100% understanding of what it takes to run the race and then, of course, have to scratch so far into it, like you said, Uniclet, in between Uniclet and Shaktulik. That was your rookie run that year, right?
Yes, it was. Yes.
So when you run the Iditarod as a rookie and have to scratch, where does that put you for the next year? Do you have to do all of your qualifiers again? I understand that there's some rule out there about 750 miles on the Iditarod Trail as well. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, you still have to. I was still able to keep my qualifying because I went the number of miles that they require, so I didn't have to do any requalifying races. On that end, being able to scratch was pretty much my biggest nightmare that I did not want to happen, and unfortunately it did. It was really disappointing. Knowing, you know, that you're that far into the race and you're getting really close to it, and just being out on the trail with your dogs and, you know, knowing that you can't make it there, it's just very disappointing kind of in you. But I'm really, really adamant about getting there this year, no matter what it takes. It was kind of a little difficult this year for training because kind of shut down for a little while here and there due to the trail conditions and weather. So this coming October, I'm going to start up training a little bit earlier and get the dogs in shape. So I'm going to train up for Iditarod.
You had mentioned, Charlie, that it's very disappointing when you're out there on the trail and you have to scratch the race. And I want to delve into that if we can a little bit. I don't think we've really discussed that here on the show. About, you know, that agony that you go through. I've been there. I had to do it last year on the Tustamina 200, you know, but I always put that well-being of my dogs first, and I think that's what every one of us do. But it's a trying time when you're sitting there wherever you're at, on the back of the sled there at the checkpoint, and you're thinking, am I going to do this? Am I not? You know, you're seeking out advice from folks, and you finally make that decision. So before we get into that, Charlie, how far were you into the 1,000-mile race before you had to make that decision?
Right around 750. I was pretty close to that. I kind of had a little question and doubt in my mind when I came into Caltech. I had to drop one of my dogs, Bernie, and right then and there I actually had called Mark Nordman and asked for a little bit of advice, and he was very, very helpful. And then I had also called GB and, you know, asked for some of his advice, because I kind of knew in the back of my mind, Robert, like, what was going to happen. But then I was like, you know, I wanted a couple other people's opinions, because you're tired at the time and just, you know, being out on the trail for, I think it was like 8 days. You know, I wanted to make sure I was thinking the right way. And I had talked to a couple other mushers that were sitting there at Caltech and asked for their advice, and then I decided, you know what, I'm going to pull the snow hook and I'm going to keep going out of Caltech, which I did. And I was very happy at that time pulling out, because the team still looked really, really well going down the trail. And then once I got to Uniclet, I was very happy to see the lights there. Very, very happy. And then I rested there for a while. And then, you know, once we left Uniclet, then I kind of saw the team was, I mean, they weren't having difficulty, but you could tell they weren't enjoying it anymore. And that's when I said, you know what, the dogs ain't enjoying it. I'm certainly not going to enjoy it, because you're seeing kind of everything unfold in front of you. And that's when I decided that, you know, it had to be the best decision with the scratch.
So you said you've been out on the trail for about 8 days at that point. Where were you in terms of, I don't recall myself, where were you in position at that point? Obviously you weren't in last place. Do you recall where you were at when you had to finally make that decision?
I think it was maybe 10th place from last place, I believe.
Okay.
10th from last. Somewhere right near there. I kind of knew like who was in front of me at times. You know, some of us were traveling together, and I kind of knew who was, like, behind us. And I really wasn't, like, concerned about any position, like, whatsoever at that time. And my biggest goal was to enter the Iditarod and do the best that I could to get to the finish line. I didn't have any position as far as, like, finishing. If it was last place, it would have been better than not finishing.
So So can you give our listeners a little bit of insight? You said that the dogs weren't enjoying it. You could see that they're tired, and I'm sure a lot of people listening today, especially a lot of recreational mushers, will think, man, I can only imagine how tired you and your dogs are at close to 800 miles. What do you start to recognize at that distance? What was that kind of the over the plateau where they just weren't doing it right anymore? What did you see? Did you see a change in attitude, a way they were eating? What did you see in your dogs that made that decision possible?
The biggest thing I saw, Robert, was their attitude. Once we left Uniclean, we were going up some of the hills. They just seemed to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I know a lot of other mushers said, you know, once you hit the coast, you're kind of home free. And I thought to myself, well, this is nowhere near home free, you know, for me or the team. And I think one of the biggest things I need to pretty much focus on this year is more hill training. For the flat runs on rivers and smaller hills, you know, we had no problem going over. But I think getting into that amount of miles in a race is when you kind of see, like, what training your dogs really need more of. And definitely my team, I think we lacked on the hills. Beginning the race, like, even rainy paths and stuff, I mean, we kind of flew through that section of trail. We did very well on that. And I was just shocked on, you know, how we got through, you know, as far as we did. I had a lot of younger dogs, but, I would have to say the attitude is probably the biggest thing that I saw. Each one of my dogs were still eating fine. I didn't have any injuries with the seven, you know, that I had left on the team, but I knew I couldn't make it that, you know, the rest of the way with only seven dogs.
So, you know, the dogs, they have no idea when the race is over, whether it's at, you know, Unicolete or Rainy Pass or whatever. When they pull into the checkpoint, they know that they're supposed to continue, but they don't know that they're supposed to continue to finish at, you know, at Nome or XYZ point. How did the dogs take it when you finally took the harness off and loaded it up in the plane or the truck and you waited for the plane, et cetera? How were they feeling or how were they looking at that point when you finally said, okay, we're going to scratch and it's time to, you know, to close this chapter? What were the dogs, I guess, emotions, if we can put it that way, on how they were acting at their end of their race?
I would say my two leaders, which are Duke and Fuzzy, they had been to Nome several times. And I could kind of almost tell that they were a little disappointed because scratching and probably not seeing, you know, the finish line. So they've been there before, so I think those two were probably disappointed. They still had a lot of energy left in them, with two, you know, 2 liters, and they're both 9 years old. So, I mean, I might try to use them again this year. I'd have to talk to TV about it because they're both of them are his dogs, but. The other ones, I think, were probably maybe a little relieved. I had a couple year-and-a-half-olds left on the team. And, I mean, they were still eating very well. And, you know, afterwards, a couple of them were, I'd say, probably just tired. You know, maybe, I wouldn't say like 15, but probably just tired. So probably half of them, I'd say, were probably happy to finish. And maybe the other three or four, I probably were disappointed. I could kind of tell.
So here we are 6-7 months later now, and it takes a tremendous amount of courage, I would imagine, to sign that check again and mail it in or drop it off at Iditarod headquarters and say, you know what, we're going to try this again. What was going through your mind at that point where you said, you know what, we're going to try to tackle this one more time?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. I had no doubt. I was just like, you know, it was a big learning experience for me as far as, you know, what to do better in training. How to pack my drop bags properly. Some of them I overpacked, some I think I underpacked. Dealing with the warmer weather this year, too. We had some open water in some areas before I did a ride. There was 3 open rivers. And going through that, we kind of had difficulty in the last one going over. We kind of got jammed up on the shore there and had to take everything out of my sled. But it was just definitely a big learning experience. I probably have to say I'm still a little disappointed I didn't finish because, you know, you're going through 6 months of training and, you know, all the money and, you know, the sponsors that you do have, you know, that obviously they wanted to see you finish and everything. And I kind of feel like I let down a lot of people, probably most likely the dogs and myself. But, you know, after that, I just thought about it for a day and said, you know what, I'm not going to give up no matter what it takes. I'm definitely going to sign up for, you know, 2014, and this year is going to be a big goal just to get to the finish line and all. So I'm pretty excited about starting training here shortly. I actually have to go on September 5th and pick up my dogs during Juneau. They were up there on the glacier on Mendenhall doing tours this summer, so they got, hopefully they got plenty of exercise and, you know, probably in a little bit better shape than they were last year at this time.
So folks that follow Iditarod knows that each year a portion of the race changes course on odd and even years. So this year you're going to be running a different trail than you attempted last year in your rookie run. Do you have any insight on that, where you stand right now in terms of the different course and maybe possible strategy that you're thinking about, or at least folks that you've spoke to about the different route than you went last year?
Everybody said that the southern route this last year is harder, and the Yukon River, I think, is pretty much what beat us up. Heading to Eagle Island was just, it was really rough on the team. The trail was very, very wind-blowing. It was still marked, but it was just wind-blowing like crazy. And I think that's pretty much what took a big toll on my dog, was going through the deep snow. Northern route, I hear, is easier, but for some reason, I feel like this year is just going to be extremely cold. So that might be another test that I'm going to have to look forward to on this year's race, as far as dealing with, you know, yourself being properly fitted with gear and, you know, making sure that your dogs are kept well equipped with dog coats and dog booties and, you know, all their protection for them. So looking forward, you know, to the northern route so I can kind of, you know, see the other checkpoints on the trail.
So you mentioned that your dogs are down in Juneau doing the tour thing in the summer. I know a lot of folks send their dogs down to do that in the summer. A lot of mushers work on those tour operations as well. How do you think that prepares them for things like Iditarod and other qualifying races, you know, 200 or 300 miles? Because they're not just, you know, they're just kind of going around a several mile course instead of long 50 mile runs at a time. How do you think that helps them train for Iditarod?
I think they kind of keep some just exercise. Probably a little bit more socialized with people, with, you know, tours coming. Because I have some younger dogs, and, you know, they're not, it's not like we have people coming every day, you know, like to the kennel to, you know, pet them and socialize with them. I mean, you know, I pretty much, you know, encourage anybody to come out to the kennel, you know, when I am there to visit with the team and the dogs and the puppies, just so they can get, like, well socialized with the people. So I think it's going to help out with socialization with them, and then just kind of repeatedly, you know, running. I know it's not far, but I think it's just for my younger dogs, just kind of getting into, like, a set pattern, like a set routine.
That is exactly my thoughts, exactly. You know, the more times that those younger dogs are in harness, the better, as far as I'm concerned. It gives them that experience working with a team, even if it's just a few miles down the trail and back. I think that helps out so much better. So you had mentioned that you had a couple of older dogs running in lead, but a lot of your other dogs were younger. What is a young dog to you? Is it like G.B. Jones's B team? Is it a puppy team? Is it a yearling team? What are we thinking about when you say younger dogs?
Younger dogs, I'd say, are yearlings, like a year and a half. We kind of had one litter that was, I think we had eight of them, and they were obviously all a year and a half, and they really didn't have, I'd say, the experience going into Iditarod. As far as training, you know, they did very well in training, but, you know, I wanted to get them into as many, you know, 200 and 300 mile races so the dogs get comfortable with, you know, running 50 miles, stopping, running 40 miles, stopping, and kind of get used to, like, a checkpoint protocol as far as when you pull into a checkpoint, you want to rest there, they're comfortable with, you know, vets looking at them, other teams parked next to you, eating, you know, out on the trail instead of in the kennel, laying on straw. So I think that was kind of like a huge disappointment to me, because, like, the younger dogs, you know, they didn't have that type of practice. I mean, you know, obviously you camp sometimes out on the trail, but it's just not the same as far as, like when you go on the rainy pass. I know some of my younger dogs, I don't really think they slept that well for the short amount of period of time I was there, because, you know, airplanes are taking off all the time, there's people, there's photographers and stuff, so I think getting a younger team, you know, into as many short races as possible before I hit a ride, I think would prepare them better, you know, for that.
Great advice for sure. Charlie, let's talk about what you do in the off-season. You had mentioned off-air that you own a landscaping business. You a lot of mushers, as the listeners know, we try our best to earn as much money as we possibly can in the summertime so we can go out there and spend weeks out on the trail in the winter. Tell us a little bit about your business. What is your specialty with the landscaping, and what else do you tackle in your off-season?
Pretty much all I do is work. Off-season, I've had this my own company for, this will be going on 23 years, and when I'm back here in Illinois, it's pretty much just focused on work. I try to squeeze as much work in as possible, so then, you know, I can have that extra money to feed dogs and pet bills and shots and, you know, sleds and equipment and booties and pretty much everything that it takes to run a kennel. So I really don't do that many other activities as far as, you know, work here. And unfortunately, this year has been really slow. We're kind of in a drought season right now. So, I mean, we do a lot of maintenance, a lot of mowing of lawns, and it's so dry out here, we're not really doing that much right now. So we're kind of a little bit slow. So that's pretty much what I do during the off season. And I was, you know, very, very happy that I was able to get the dogs up on the glacier, because it saves me a little bit of money on dog food, you know, during the summertime.
Right. When you are here in Alaska, where do you keep your dogs? Give some folks an idea of geography on where you stay during your time up in Alaska. Where are you running from?
I'm running out of Kinnick, and that's about mile 14 of KGB, and just got really, really well-groomed trails out there. The guys that are out there on snow machines that are grooming, they just doing a fantastic job. A lot of their time is donated and stuff, and trails are pretty much, I'd say, probably maybe not even a quarter mile from the kennel, and kennel just connects right to the historic Iditarod Trail. So we have plenty of trails out there where we could run, you know, out to Flathorn Lake, Gnomestein. So really, really love the area out there. It's a lot of other mushers are live in the same area.
There's a lot of mushing history right there on those first few miles, isn't there?
Yes, there is, yep. And we're probably about... the Iditarod Trail Kennel, that's the name, is about, I'd say, about a mile from Kinnick Lake.
Very cool. So we've talked a lot about, you know, taking the time to scratch and all that leads up to it, and, of course, training in the off-season up on the glacier and what you're doing. What are you thinking about heading into this Iditarod? I know we're about 6 months out. I had on Lisbeth Norris last week, and we talked about that eternal countdown clicker on Iditarod.com, and she looks at that ever so often. She's also running as a rookie, and she says, man, every time I look at it, it's getting closer and closer. What are you going through right now, you know, 6 months out or so?
I'm still pretty calm. I mean, it's coming very quick. I look at it often, too. I said, oh, geez, look at how much time, and then look at it a couple weeks later, and it just seems like it moves up, you know, a month almost at a time. I mean, it does come quick. My biggest thing is just getting back up to Alaska and start training with the dogs, and hopefully we get some snow, like, early, like around Halloween or even earlier, and just get the dogs in repeatedly just training them every day and, you know, getting miles up on them and getting them in shape.
So explain to our listeners how you go about that. You know, everybody has their little secret method or secret sauce, I guess you could say, in early training that leads up to a race. I know Vern Halter says that a dog team should have 2,000 miles on them before they attempt to do Iditarod. What's kind of your secret in leading up to the big race in terms of training or miles or time out on the trail?
I agree with Vern on miles. I'd say they should be up to that. If they could have a little bit more, that would be great. He's a very good role model. I've asked him advice on a few races, and he's very knowledgeable and very helpful. And we start out training, I'd say, probably 3-4 miles, you know, from the start. This year we'll probably start out a little bit more, and then we just slowly start increasing the miles and just, you know, working the dogs, getting them where they... you know, where they're strong enough where they can pull. I put quite a bit of weight in the sled, and we pretty much just repeatedly run in the same trails. We try to switch it up a little bit, and that's really about it. It's just getting miles on them and seeing which dogs can lead position. That's another big thing I like to work on, is which dog will do well in which position you put them in. Like in the fall time, I kind of hope that there's some standing water where we can go through, with the ATV. Because some dogs, if they're puppies, they really haven't gone through water. And I kind of hope we have standing water in some areas, like around KGB, so then the dogs can get used to, running through the water. Because, like I said earlier, in this Iditarod, we had some open streams, and, some of my younger dogs were kind of a little... We weren't sure what to do, but just work on leader training, position, and getting yourself pretty much mentally and physically, ready for the race.
Let's talk a little bit about sponsors. Sponsors are always a big part of everybody that's attempting to do Iditarod. Do you have any sponsors you would like to send a shout-out to, or how can people find out about you so they can potentially find out about being a sponsor for your team?
Okay, I have a website. It's iditarodmusher.com.
Very cool domain name there.
Yep, and I was very fortunate where G.B. Jones had that website when he was mushing a few years back, and he had willingly let me continue the name and, use the website name. So I have pictures up there of last Iditarod. I got the story of pretty much what happened with my last Iditarod, and I get pictures of each one of our dogs and some sponsorship ideas, and where people can buy a round of kibble or sponsor a dog. And as far as sponsorship, I really have it's just a ton of small sponsors. I had some miscellaneous ones. I do definitely want to thank GB for letting me run out of his property, which is very, very thankful for. He's let me do a lot on his property. He kind of gave me half of it and said, this is your half, and you do what you want to do, and he's got his half. So we're very, very lucky and fortunate to be running out of where I am. And I'd like to thank Jason Tranchatella, who's done a lot of building of dog houses and shed, and he's helped out an awful lot with constructing teams and building, putting an electrician in and stuff like that. And then I'd like to also thank John Hitzer, who pretty much runs my snow plowing company in the wintertime. When I'm in Alaska, he pretty much runs my business down here in Illinois.
Every one of us has that group of team members, whatever they're doing, whether, like you said, your partner down there that runs your business in the off season, or folks that help you with electricity and construction. All of us have a very vast network of folks that we depend on to try to reach that common goal of getting to know them, or getting to the start line, or whatever we're trying to do. Charlie, what was that website one more time?
It's iditarodmusher.com.
iditarodmusher.com. And I know you're very active on a pretty new form of social media, Instagram. That's where I came across your page and some of your awesome pictures of your puppies there. Lots of photos on there of your dogs and what you're all about. I think that's a cool way for us to kind of tell our story as mushers, instead of everybody doing it on Facebook like they do.
Exactly. Yeah, I started kind of putting some stuff on there. I really haven't been on there the last couple of weeks. I've kind of been focusing on work down here, trying to get things scheduled for when I do leave. Once I go up there, we still have another 2 months of work down here, and I try to get things scheduled where I keep my crews busy as far as planting and getting things ready for the winter. So I kind of just been focusing a lot on business right now. So I haven't really done that much on there. I'm probably going to be getting a Facebook page possibly going. I know there's a lot of other mushers that have them on there. I hate to be have another musher out on Facebook where, they're looking for sponsorship and stuff like that. But I most likely will do that. And then basically, through the website is where I got, a lot of sponsors, and just old sponsors from GB and people that I know, family and friends and stuff like that. So and the sponsorship is hard now, just with the way the economy is, but we do what we can, so.
There you go. Charlie, I ask every person that's on the show that this one piece of advice you can give to that recreational guy or that guy that's guy or gal that's moving up to Alaska to chase that Iditarod dream, what's that one piece of advice you could give them to help them on their quest?
Oh, good question. I have a lot of advice, but I'd say the biggest one is never give up. And no matter how hard it is, you know, training, financial-wise or in races and stuff, just never give up and just follow your goal. I know, you know, some guys, they want to give up easy. I thought about it here and there, you know, through a couple races, you're going through a hard time, you're down to a few dogs, and it's not a thing for me to give up on anything. And just, I definitely need to finish 2014 so I can, you know, finish it and get this underneath my belt. So it's a big chapter that I definitely want to close. And no matter, you know, if you have like a health condition or not, you can work your way through it. I'm actually type 1 diabetic. I know most people don't know it, but on the race, it's a lot more things that I have to do as far as preparing for Iditarod and watching my blood sugar and everything else while out on the trail and making sure insulin doesn't freeze up and stuff. So it's a bigger task for me, you know, than a lot of other mushers that, you know, and I'm sure some other ones might have, you know, diabetes also, or, you know, another medical condition, but I'm not going to let that stand in my way. And one other musher who has influenced my dream to do Iditarod is Bruce Linton. He's also type 1 diabetic, and I had met him years ago, and, you know, I saw him do Iditarod, and I said, you know what, if he can do it, I can do it. So hopefully that'll come true this coming year.
Very cool. Never give up is Charlie's piece of advice. Charlie Baena is the name. I hope I didn't butcher it that time.
Right.
Is our guest today. IditarodMusher.com is his website. Charlie, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay. Thanks, I appreciate it.
Thank you. So on behalf of our guest today, we'll see you.